This podcast is brought to you by the Village of Bedford Park, your home for business. Over 450 businesses strong and growing with a safe, reliable Lake Michigan water supply. Visit VOBPbiz.com and bring your business home to the Village of Bedford Park.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/recommend today.
Now, the WBBM Noon Business Hour.
WBBM News Time 12:03. Great to have you with us for the Wednesday, November 21st edition of the Noon Business Hour. I'm Jennifer Kuiper in for Cisco Cotto, and the Noon Business Hour is presented by the Village of Bedford Park. And on today's Noon Business Hour, we'll talk about the latest on trying to get a stimulus deal. Netflix growth slows, used cars are flying off of lots. And on Personal Finance Wednesday, what to do if you are suddenly find yourself retired. First, we have starting Friday, by the way, indoor service will be barred at restaurants in Kane, DuPage, Will, and Kankakee counties, and we'll cover that in our next segment. But right now, a Federal Reserve governor and a top investment firm are among those weighing in on a pandemic stimulus bill. We get the latest from Peter Cardillo, chief market economist, Spartan Capital Securities out of New York. Peter, we're talking about Federal Reserve Governor Lael Brainard, and what does he say about the fiscal support that's needed and the effort to get a stimulus deal here?
Yeah, well, obviously, you know, many of the Fed members are all singing to the same tune. They all saying that, the economic rebound is uneven and we need stimulus. And in fact, Pelosi has extended her deadline and is talking with Mnuchin, with the White House, to come up with some sort of a deal. And of course, you know, the market basically is reacting to that. In fact, you know, there are two markets that suggest to me that that we will get a stimulus deal, and I'm referring to the U.S. currency, which is under severe pressure today. If you look at the dollar index, it's down about 55 points as we speak, and if you look at the treasuries, yields are going through the roof again. The 10-year is now yielding a little over 8%. At 8.04, and so that is two markets in the opposite direction. And the reason for that is obviously the dollar foreign exchange people are expecting a deal, and that means more. You know, higher deficits and a weaker dollar ahead, and the bond market is suggesting that a deal as well, because that means that as the deficits continue to grow, people are going to be demanding more for their money, and so that is the yield factor, obviously. And so those two markets are a good indicator of what is about to happen.
What about Goldman Sachs? What did the bank have to say about the stimulus deal? Or lack of thereof,
well,
I should say.
That it's unlikely that we'll get something, before the elections. But I think that they could be wrong. I think we will get an agreement, whether or not the agreement is passed before election. And that's what they're referring to, by the way. That's a different story. But I think we'll have some sort of an agreement in place. And that's basically what the market is looking for. And, you know, it's quite interesting because next Thursday we're going to get a glimpse of GDP, the first round of GDP numbers for the third quarter, and they're going to be very explosive. They can be in excess of 22% growth. That is a growth rate of in excess of 22%. But obviously a number that is not really telling you the whole picture, basically fictitious in the sense that these numbers will be portraying an economy that came out of a steep, steep decline. And so it's, rising from the ashes. But the reality is that growth is dwindling, and we need stimulus to avoid a double-dip recession.
That's Peter Cardillo, Chief Market Economist, Spartan Capital Securities out of New York. Coming up, restaurants in the south and west suburbs face another challenge from the COVID crisis. A second wave of coronavirus infections has prompted Governor Pritzker to order tighter restrictions on restaurants in DuPage, Kane, Will, and Kankakee counties. We welcome Greg Hines, columnist of Crane Chicago Business. And Greg, some restaurant owners might say, hey, wait a minute, why are you targeting us? This is unfair. You know, you still have supermarkets open and home improvement stores, places where people gather a lot. And there has been a call for the governor to prove that the restaurants is the would be the problem here. What's your take on this?
Well, the governor's people claim that they have some evidence that indeed when the virus spreads, that it mostly spreads either in small family situations or more typically large gatherings, and even more typically than that in bars and restaurants, which tend to be indoors. At least that's what the Pritzker's latest order goes to. People tend to take off their masks. Particularly if they're drinking, they let their inhibitions down a little bit. Everybody's close together. And, you know, and usually when people go out for a drink or drinks, it's not just a five-minute stop. It's a long stop. So you have a lot of people with loose inhibitions in a small space all at once. And that kicks off the virus. At least that's what the Pritzker people are arguing. That's what they say the contact tracing of infected cases shows, and that's what they claim other evidence points to.
How close is Chicago to this? I mean, the positivity rate looked high yesterday, so it has to be three consecutive days of, over 8%, and then the restrictions kick in?
We have a ways to go. We haven't even had one day of 8%, much less three, and we're still a point or a point and a half short of that. I don't think Mayor Lightfoot wants to go there because the city's restaurant industry is really important to our economy and has been really whacked. And I think she'll have a little more forbearance even than Pritzker. But he gets the final word on this in the sense that if he wants to issue the order, he can. She can issue tougher orders if she wants. Not yet, but if the numbers don't start to reverse in the next week or two, I think even the mayor has hinted that something's going to have to happen.
Anything we're not seeing here, Greg, that when you look at the handling of all of this from the governor's office to the mayor's office to the suburban mayors to the local health officials, anything that in particular that you've been keeping your eye on?
Well, what I don't see, I'm going to go bigger picture than that, Jennifer. What I don't see is any kind of consensus anymore. You would think in a rational society, people would be able to come to agreement on what the situation is and what we need to do about it. But instead, every aspect of it has become politicized. I mean, the very concept of wearing masks, which as Pritzker put it, there's stacks and stacks of studies show that they work in preventing transmission, has become kind of a national symbol of machismo. I mean, if you're a real man, you don't wear a mask. There are some people who proudly strut around, claim that, it's not going to happen. If it does, we're going to get herd immunity or whatever. The consensus that's needed to come up with a plan and stick to the plan and get this over with as soon as possible just isn't there. And that's what I see that's missing.
Greg, just want to change a little bit here and ask you, you're the man in the know. What do you take? What's your take on the mayor's Chicago budget, the proposal that's just been unveiled?
Three or four things. One, it has a property tax increase of about $94 million. That is not going to be very popular right now, particularly with aldermen. And the question is whether the federal government is going to finally pass the second COVID stimulus bill that would provide some money to the city. If we get an additional bunch of money from Washington, my suspicion is that property tax increase is going to go bye-bye. Two, there are some layoffs. Everybody's going to have 5 days. Every city employee is going to have to take 5 furlough days. There's some vacancies, 1,800 that won't be filled. That's not going to be popular with labor unions. They have a lot of friends at City Hall, so we'll see if that sticks. And three, what I think the financial watchdogs, if not ordinary people, are going to look at is the incredible amount of borrowing here. The city claimed it had Lightfoot said the city had a $1.2 billion budget hole. Well, she's going to fill $500 million of it and another $400 million toward this year's budget by refinancing city debt. And while she's talking about, well, we're going to get a cheaper interest rate, and that's where the money is, the city is also going to extend the term in which they repay the debt, which means we're going to improve our cash flow today, we're going to drive up the bills down the road. And in fact, if you look at the details, which I've started to do, city debt service, the amount of money we have to pay every year to pay off old borrowing, will be higher every year from 2023 to 2050. That's a heck of a cost. And I would hope that the aldermen take a real close look about whether it might be smarter to just tighten our belt a little bit more this year rather than just pass the cost on to our kids and grandkids.
Thanks, Greg Hines, columnist, Crane Chicago Business. Up next, an update on the highly competitive streaming wars.
The WBBM Noon Business Hour continues.
Netflix has missed the mark on new subscriptions in the quarter just ended. We are joined by Tim Hanlon, founder and CEO of the Verité Group. And Tim, how did Netflix do with Q3 earnings, and what's the guidance that the company's given on this?
Hey, Jennifer, the guidance was actually a little bit lower than most people were expecting. That said, you have to put all of this in context, right? So Netflix only, in quotes, added 2.5 million new subscribers in the United States, which was down from a more torrid pace the quarters preceding, which is about 10 million per quarter. I think more people, I guess, on Wall Street figured that, hey, you know, with people still largely, if not confined to their homes, certainly still spending a lot more time watching television or their streaming devices, that Netflix's subscriber base would actually go up and still significantly. But the reality is that, the company still has almost 200 million subscribers across the globe. And the United States is just obviously one part of it. And I think the reality is that some of what they announced yesterday in terms of being somewhat muted in terms of performance last quarter is specific to Netflix, but frankly is also broadly affecting the streaming space overall. And I think that's some interesting stuff to watch for sure.
So there are other players in this. Netflix is at the top, but is there any threat here to Netflix?
Well, certainly Netflix is everybody's target, right? Because it's in every basically streaming person's home. It's the big gun, and it's gargantuan in terms of its scale and girth. There's a lot more competition, however, right? And that's sort of one part of it. Every major media company is girding for battle. And literally in the last couple of weeks, it's been just a daisy chain of executive shifts and shuffles as they all tried to sort of laser focus themselves against Netflix. But the reality is that all of them are compromised by production in the COVID era, right? There's a huge shot against all kinds of original production. So a lot of the programming that all of these services desperately need isn't fast in coming because there are a lot of studios and a lot of production facilities that are shut down, or at least heavily held back by a lot of the restrictions around COVID. So everybody's fighting for new content, and it's going to be harder to come by, certainly in the next number of months.
Will Netflix spend more for content, trying to get ahead of the others in trying to bring in that new stuff?
Well, certainly that's what Netflix's go-to has been, right? And they've racked up a lot of debt trying to do that. There's no question that new content is feeds the beast. But the reality is that they're probably going to have to raise prices or, God forbid, maybe incorporate some level of advertising, a debatable hot topic, but I think it's possible someday, to bring in some more revenue to allow further acquisition of more content and maybe pay down some of that debt.
That's Tim Hanlon. Thanks, Tim, founder and CEO of the Verité Group here in Chicago. And still ahead in Personal Finance Wednesday, dealing with an unexpected sudden retirement.
The WBBM Noon Business Hour continues.
Good afternoon. I'm Jennifer Kuiper. These are the top stories on News Radio WBBM. Mayor Lightfoot's pandemic budget includes a hike in property taxes. A drug maker will pay a price for its alleged role in the opioid crisis. In Personal Finance Wednesday, help with what to do should you find yourself thrust into retirement. And the market for used cars is very hot during the pandemic. WBBM Business, the Dow right now is down 31 points. The S&P 500 is up almost 2 points. NASDAQ is up almost 6 points. Oil is down almost 4.5%. WBBM News Time, 12:30. Mayor Lightfoot has released her budget plan, and it features a property tax hike that is linked to inflation. She also says that she has struggled personally with the idea of layoffs and has done her best to limit them.
Across all funds, we have reduced over 1,800 vacancies. All departments, including police and fire, gave something. This budget we are presenting today also contains layoffs of approximately 350 positions.
The mayor says reduced revenues in the pandemic have created an $800 million shortfall in this year's budget and a $1.2 billion gap in the 2021 plan. Purdue Pharma, the company that makes the powerful prescription painkiller OxyContin, will plead guilty to federal criminal charges as part of a settlement of more than $8 billion. First Assistant U.S. Attorney Rachel Honig says other prosecutions are still possible.
This resolution does not provide anybody with a pass on the criminal side. Purdue is pleading guilty to three felonies and faces a substantial forfeiture judgment and criminal fine. This resolution does not provide a criminal release or an agreement not to prosecute for any individual, and our criminal investigation regarding individuals is ongoing.
The guilty pleas involve conspiracy to defraud the U.S. government and violation of federal anti-kickback laws. WBBM News Time, 12:32.
Money talks as the WBBM Noon Business Hour continues.
Markets are a little higher. We're joined by Chuck Carlson, CEO of Horizon Investment Services and publisher of the Dow Theory Forecast newsletter. Chuck, the markets have kind of been all over today. What's your take on what's playing out here?
Yeah, it feels like they're on a bit of a holding pattern here today. We've been trading plus or minus very little around the even line today, and most of the averages. A couple of the more economically sensitive indices, such as the Russell 2000 and the Dow Jones Transportation Average, are showing a little bit more weakness here, and that may be a little bit of a response to this whole notion of stimulus. Will it happen? Won't it happen? Will it happen before the election? Will it happen after the election, et cetera, and that uncertainty. But beyond that, it's pretty much kind of a, I don't want to say a nothing day in the market, but a pretty steady hand right now in the market.
If you were to say who the winners and losers are right now, what would you say?
The losers, at least, you know, for the first half of the day, again, are more of the economically sensitive stocks. You see that in the performance of the Russell 2000 small caps, which is down about 0.5%, and in the Dow Jones Transportation Average, which may be the most economically sensitive index there is, and that's down more than 0.5%. But I don't want to make too much of that. But again, these aren't huge moves either way. And when you look at the broader indices, such as the S&P 500, and the Dow, you know, they're plus or minus about 10 basis points, right around zero. So, and it's an interesting day because, you know, we are starting to get a little bit more earnings coming out. And typically corporate earnings, you know, as they start to get announced, will add to the volatility of the market. And as we get closer, obviously, to Election Day, you would expect some volatility to pick up as well. But we're not seeing that today. So it's kind of an interesting day in the fact that we have less volatility than you would expect.
When you look at earnings season so far and what you've seen, anything that has surprised you, interesting, or just is it sort of ho-hum?
Yeah, well, I think, you know, we're very, very early in the process. That is really going to start to pick up in earnest here later this week and especially next week. But what I have seen so far has been one, companies reporting results that are beating expectations, which isn't unusual. But I'm also seeing kind of a lack in most cases of a big response to those earnings in either direction. So it's at least initially it's giving the impression that the market was expecting to have a decent corporate earnings quarter, but it had already kind of reflected that in stock prices. Again, we'll get a better read on that, especially beginning next week, but that seems to be the early indication thus far.
And we had an earlier guest who seemed to express some concern about next week with the GDP numbers. Any expectations that you have there?
Well, that GDP number is going to be all over the map. And I mean, there, you know, you have such a wide variance in the expectation for that. I'm not sure, to be quite frank, the variance is so broad that I'm not sure that that's going to have a huge implication on the market. I think the bigger issue are going to be how do some of these bellwether stocks come out with earnings, and we start to see those next week in the case of you know, Alphabet and I believe Apple's earnings are next week. And we start to see a number of kind of big companies, Microsoft, which I guess is later this week, will start coming out with earnings. And that, I think, will have a much greater impact on the market, quite frankly.
That's Chuck Carlson, CEO of Horizon Investment Services and publisher of the Dow Theory Forecast newsletter. Thanks, Chuck. And up next in Personal Finance Wednesday, dealing with a surprise retirement.
Information to make cash and save cash. The WBBM Noon Business Hour continues.
It's Personal Finance Wednesday. The pandemic appears to be forcing early retirements, both voluntary and forced. Let's get some survival tips from Liz Weston, columnist of NerdWallet and author of the books Your Credit Score, the fifth edition, and Deal with Your Debt. And Liz, when we look at this, how has the pandemic affected retirement and the decision to call it quits earlier than maybe even someone planned?
Well, Jennifer, I think it's coming in two directions. One is that there are obviously more layoffs and furloughs and people without work, but also there are a lot of older people who are just thinking, you know, the exposure is not worth it. It's not worth my life. So they're taking themselves out of the labor market a little bit earlier than they expected. Most people, or a lot of people at least, do retire sooner than they planned, but this seems to be pushing more people over that line.
So that means you have to be lean. How lean do you have to be if you find yourself out earlier than thought?
Well, it really depends on your circumstances. There are a lot of ways to get this wrong, only a few ways to get this right. So right off the top, I'd say, even if you've never talked to a financial advisor before, now's the time to do so because they've guided many, many people through retirement. This is your basically your one and only shot, so you want to get it right. I think the first thing you've got to do, obviously, is take a look at what your expenses are, see where you can cut, and make sure that it matches the income that's coming in. I think it's also super important to, if you can, delay Social Security, and I know that seems counterintuitive when you need money, but for most people, they're going to live long enough where those checks are really going to need to be maximized. So it's important to get all the facts about this and not just wing it or think you understand things that you actually aren't an expert in, I guess.
Is that something that it's hard to navigate through Social Security by yourself, so you might want to get somebody to help you out with that?
It is ridiculously complicated. Yeah. I don't know how something that covers so many people can be so complicated, but it really is. It's changed a lot in recent years. So at the very least, go to a Social Security claiming calculator. There's a good one. It's free at AARP. If you have a complicated situation, if you have minor children, if you have a government pension, you may need to pay $20 to $50 to use a more powerful version like Maximize My Social Security or Social Security Solutions. But definitely do at least that so you understand what you may be giving up if you go for Social Security early.
Liz, are there income resources that we might not think of, some that are often forgotten?
Yeah, your home, if you do own a home, can be a powerful source of income, either getting a reverse mortgage if you're over 62, and again, you need a lot of good objective advice about that. Another option is to sell the house and downsize. If you were thinking about doing that at some point, do it early while you still have the energy to deal with a relocation and moving and all that entails.
And what about when you're starting to come up with that retirement budget, what are the must-have expenses, things you just can't do without, you need?
The most important must-have is health insurance, and I know it's going to be expensive. A lot of people will just want to, if they do have insurance through their employer, they'll just want to continue with COBRA, which gives you up to 18 months of your coverage, but that is the most expensive route. I know it's the coverage you understand and you're comfortable with, but at least take a look at the Obamacare exchanges, the ACA exchanges, and see if you can't get a better deal, because those are tax subsidized. You can get a tax subsidy to cut down the cost. With COBRA, you're paying the whole thing, and it can cost $20,000 or more a year to pay for health insurance for a family. So you need all the help you can get. The one thing you don't want to do is go bare. We are in a pandemic. It's never a good idea to be without health insurance, but now it would be insane. If there's any way that you can get coverage, get coverage.
One thing that I noticed you did say was consider downsizing, perhaps radically, and that's a little scary. So what are we looking at there?
Well, that's interesting. If you have an adventurous streak at all, maybe take a look at sites like International Living or Live and Invest Overseas. I've talked to a lot of people who retired early by going abroad, and they are sharing their experiences through blogs and sharing their experiences on that site. People can live very well in other countries that have good health care, by the way, for a lot less than they're living here in the United States. So one gentleman I talked to basically went through the last recession, lost most of his retirement savings, lost his business, and has moved overseas and never looked back.
That's Liz Weston, columnist for NerdWallet and author of the books Your Credit Score, the fifth edition, and Deal With Your Debt. She's based out of Los Angeles, and Personal Finance Wednesday is sponsored by Mesirow Wealth Management. Join us at this time tomorrow for Technology Thursday, and still to come, the market for used cars is on fire.
A deposit for your future. The WBBM Noon Business Hour continues.
Used car prices are in the U.S. Are rising so fast that they're being seen as a driver of inflation. We're joined by Jeff Gilbert, CBS Auto reporter out of Detroit. And Jeff, what has been the situation with used cars?
Yeah, the prices, as you mentioned, are going nowhere but up. There are a couple of reasons for that, Jennifer. One is that in many cases, there's not as much choice in new cars. Another is new cars are getting more expensive. And the third issue is that there are some people who just don't want to do public transportation. So they're going in the vehicle market. And for them, it's going to be a used car because used cars are generally less expensive. So it's supply and demand. There's more demand for used cars. And that is pushing up the prices.
Used cars, what's the inventory like? We saw a dwindling of them during the recession when this happened.
Yeah, we had the dwindling inventory of new cars as well, and that's putting pressure on the inventories of used cars. So there are a lot out there because the used car universe is just a lot larger. Now, for a consumer, that's actually good news if you're looking to trade in a vehicle because dealers want that used vehicle, so you're going to get top dollar.
Ford did that. They did offer the if you lose your job, you could turn your car in within a certain period of time. Did any evidence that that helped them at all through this?
You know, that was something that probably wasn't used a lot, but it was a goodwill gesture. So it got a lot of people thinking well about Ford and going, okay, I'm maybe I'll do something because it's less of a risk. But in general, when car companies do that, they really don't get a lot of people turning back their vehicles.
So if somebody is thinking about turning in their vehicle, might they get a little bit more than they would have, say, just a few months ago?
Yeah, exactly. And it seems to be around the peak now and maybe a little past the peak. Most of the analysts I talk with say this is not going to be a long-term phenomenon. This is just something that is very specific to market conditions right now. So if you do have a vehicle that you're thinking of selling on the used market, take a look at prices at the various Edmunds.com, KellyBlueBook.com sites on the internet and see what your vehicle is actually worth. You may be surprised.
Jeff, I am not going to let you get away without answering this one. GM has introduced the electric Hummer pickup. What do you think of that?
I think it's beautiful. I think it's going to be fast. I think it's going to be a lot of fun, but they're not going to make a lot of them because $113,000 is a lot of money for a vehicle.
Sure is. Looks very muscular, too. Very heavy, big, which
right.
You would expect with the Hummer.
Right. And what this is it shows what you can do with an electric vehicle, and it kind of is meant to change the image of electric vehicles.
Is that why they went with the—well, how about pickup? Why did they decide to go on the pickup route? Because of how popular they are these days?
Yeah, what's more macho than a pickup truck? I mean, the idea was people think of electric vehicles as glorified golf carts. Let's show them what an electric vehicle can do. Pickup because you've got a lot of attributes there. Off-road because it can go off-road. And 1,000 horsepower, well, just because we can.
Excellent. Jeff Gilbert, CBS Auto reporter out of Detroit, Michigan. Thanks for joining us. You'll find past programs and later today a podcast of this hour at WBBMNewsRadio.com and the Radio.com app.